Thanks very much, Elizabeth. It's a pleasure to be here today to talk at this event. It's on a heart very a subject very dear to my heart. And thanks very much for Jeff and Pavel for inviting me along here to speak today. The other reason why I'm pleased to speak here today, and I can give a free plug for Macquarie here, is that a large number of, in my former job as head of the financial markets area, a large number of my staff did the Masters of Applied Finance at Macquarie over any number of years, and it's been a major source of education for a lot of our team. So there's a nice free plug for you all. So what I'm going to talk today is some issues, as Elizabeth said, around risk and return in a low-rate environment and very much in line with the theme of the conference. And I'm going to highlight some questions that strike me as worth asking about the way return and risk are reflected in the current configuration of asset prices. I will suggest some considerations worth thinking about in trying to answer those questions from the investor side. And I'll also describe how some issuers have adjusted their strategies to take advantage of the low-rate environment. And so just to give you a quick idea, so I'm going to talk about what is it about the current structure of low interest rates and some of the detail around that. Spend a bit of time talking about low volatility, or mostly low volatility. Then talk about some changing demand and supply dynamics which are coming down the pipe right at the moment, actually, in the sovereign bond market and how that might affect rates and volatility. And then, as I said, talk a bit about issuance in a low-rate environment. So one of the main points I'd like to make is that the low interest rate structure that we see today underpins many asset prices. I mean, it's a fairly basic point, but I think one worth remembering. So that is, asset prices which might look expensive in some long-run sense are more reasonably priced given that the rate structure currently is at historically low levels. So if you take the rate structure as given and assume it's going to stay there, that validates any number of other asset prices. So in my view, a fundamental question that you need to think about as an investor is, will the current rate structure remain at these levels, or will it return to the higher levels we have seen in the past? If the rate structure remains near its historic lows, then valuations can persist. But if it rises, then asset valuations need to be reassessed. The second and related question to that is, what is the risk that such a shift in the rate structure occurs, and am I being adequately compensated for that risk? And I'll come to talk about that a bit later on. So I'm going to use the rate structure in the US, and particularly the yield on the US 10-year bond, as a shorthand way of illustrating the shift in the rate structure. So here we are. Here's a longish history of 10-year US Treasury yields. If I took it back to the 50s, then you'd see some periods around then where the current rate structure doesn't look, current level of the 10-year yield doesn't look so unusual. But nevertheless, you can see that yields are at a pretty low level. So as you are all aware, in the wake of the financial crisis and the sharp decline in global growth and inflation, monetary policy rates around the world were reduced to historically low levels. In a number of countries, and Australia being one notable exception, the policy rate was lowered to its effective lower bound, which in some cases was even in negative territory. So in part reflecting the low level of policy rates and the slow nominal growth post-crisis, long-term bond yields also declined to historically low levels. 10-year government bond yields in some countries, including Germany, Japan and Switzerland, have been negative at various times in recent years. So just to give you a nice number, in 2015, over $14 trillion worth of sovereign paper had negative yields, which, billions and trillions you can bandy around, but $14 trillion is big in anyone's book. For the past decade, the yield structure in the US has been lower than at any time previously. So if you're thinking about the whole curve, it's been lower than at any point in the past. So let me put in context the current excitement about the 10-year yield in the US reaching 3%, which is nearly done in recent weeks. In the 3 decades prior to 2007, as you can see on this picture, the low point for the yield, for the 10-year yield, was 3.11%. So here we are getting excited about yields coming back up to 3. In days gone by, we're getting very excited about the fact that even the yield had declined as low as 3%. So all this goes to say that we have been living in a period of unusually low nominal bond yields. So the question is, how long will this period last? That's a fundamental question you need to ask as an investor. So one way to think about this question is to ask whether what we are seeing is a realisation of a tail event in the historical distribution of interest rates. So while this tail event has now lasted quite a long time, if you thought it was a tail event, then you would expect yields to revert back to the historical mean or somewhere around that at some point. You also wouldn't change your assessment of the distribution of future realisations of interest rates. On the other hand, it might be the case that the yield structure has shifted to a permanently lower level because of, I'm just throwing this out there as an example, you believe in secular stagnation, resulting in structurally lower growth rates for the major economies for the foreseeable future. If this were the case, you would change your assessment of future interest rate outcomes. Now, I don't know the answer to this question, so I'm going to ask a whole bunch of questions and I'm not going to tell you the answer. That's for you to work out. But I don't know the answer to that question, but it has material implications for asset pricing. So is it the case that the distribution is the same as it ever was and all we're seeing is a realisation in the tail, or has all the distribution shifted to the left, shifted closer to zero? As I said earlier, the prices of many assets can be broadly validated if you believe the low rate structure is here to stay. This is because, again, fairly basic asset pricing. The lower rate structure means that the rate with which you discount expected future returns on your asset is lower, and hence the asset price is higher for any given future flow of earnings. So the current constellation of asset prices seem to be based on the view that the global economy can grow strongly with associated strong earnings growth, but that strong growth isn't going to lead to any material increase in inflationary pressure. So you might want to question how long such a benign conjuncture could actually last. Current asset pricing suggests that the average expectation of market participants is that it will last for quite a long while yet. It is also worth pointing out that it is possible that a move higher in interest rates occurs alongside higher expected nominal dividends because of even higher real growth. If this was to occur, it would not necessarily imply that asset prices have to adjust, i.e. if the numerator goes up by the same as the denominator, then the price doesn't have to change. So it really depends on the relative movements in the numerator and the denominator of your asset pricing equation. So how might we know whether this distribution of interest rates has actually shifted or not? So one can think of the interest rate distribution as being anchored around the neutral rate of interest, and I talked about this in the Australian context last year. So as I said then, empirically, the neutral rate of interest is difficult to estimate. So it's difficult to estimate where it's been. It's even harder to forecast where it's going to be. The factors which affect it are often slow-moving, although sometimes they aren't slow-moving, most notably around the time of the onset of the financial crisis in 07-08, where estimates of the neutral rate declined rapidly and significantly. So currently, there's a debate in the US as to whether the neutral rate of interest has bottomed and is actually shifting up. This raises the question as to the degree and speed with which such a movement in the neutral rate in the US might transmit globally. So as I said, I'm helpfully throwing out all these questions and just not throwing out any answers whatsoever. All of these questions, though, highlight to me the inherent uncertainty about the future evolution of interest rates. So you can decide that interest rates are going to continue to remain lower for longer, but I struggled to see how one can hold that view with any great conviction. Yet there appears to me to be very little, if any, compensation for this uncertainty, particularly in fixed income markets. So most estimates of the term premium, don't have to worry about too much about where exactly this current estimate is, but it's generally in the vicinity of zero is the important point to take away, regardless of where exactly it is. But most estimates of the term premium in the 10-year US Treasury yield are around zero or even negative. So investors aren't receiving any additional compensation for holding an asset with duration. So as I said, you can believe the interest rate structure has shifted down, is going to stay there forever, but there's got to be at least a little bit of uncertainty as to how likely that state of affairs is going to be, particularly given how unusual it is in history. So, as I said, you can have different views about the longevity of the current rate structure, but in part reflecting the fact that you can have different views about longevity as well as the unusual nature of the current environment, there seems to me that there's got to be a significant degree of uncertainty about the future, yet many asset prices don't obviously offer any compensation for that uncertainty. And it's not only in the term structure of interest rates where compensation for uncertainty is low. Measures of implied volatility indicate that compensation for uncertainty about the path of many other financial prices is also low and has been low for some time. So I'll just show you a few variants of this. So ignore the spike right at the end, because I'm going to come back to that in a second. But if you have a look, this is over a longish period of time, but you can see particularly over the last couple of years, so those in all of these asset markets up until basically the last couple of months, implied vol had been low right across the board for most of 2017 and a decent chunk of 2016. And as I said, it's across asset classes, it's across countries, and across individual sectors within. So it's not just an aggregate story. If you look here, so I've broken up the US equity market into its four main components, and you can see there through 26 and 2017, implied vol, or this is actually realized vol, but it was, was actually pretty low for quite a long period of time there. So as I said, it's not just a story of one particular asset class, it's a story of all asset classes. So I'll discuss some of the possible explanations for this low volatility, drawing on some material we put out in the RBA's statement on monetary policy in February. And also I'll talk about that spike there at the end, if I go back one, particularly that one in the top left in US equity markets, and what are some of the potential factors around that. So implied vol is derived from prices of financial options, obviously, and just as the term premium measures compensation for uncertainty about the future path of interest rates, implied volatility reflects uncertainty about the future price of the asset underlying a financial option. The more certain an investor is of the future value of the underlying asset, or the higher their risk tolerance, the lower the volatility implicit in the option price. Thus, one interpretation of the recent low level of volatility is that market participants have been more confident in their estimates of future outcomes. And that's consistent with the observed reduction in the variability of many macro indicators. So here we go. Here we've got just estimated actual volatility on GDP on the left-hand side. So you can see over the last few years, it's actually been pretty low for quite a long period of longish period of time relative to history. And then on the right-hand side, you can see the volatility in forecast. You can see the movement in forecast revisions. So the low volatility, low volatility pricing is consistent with the observed reduction in the variability of many macro indicators such as GDP and inflation, and a decline in the frequency and magnitude of the revisions that analysts have made to their forecasts of such variables, which is the right-hand side. Given the importance of these variables as inputs into the pricing of financial assets, it's not so surprising that greater investor certainty about their future values has in turn given investors more certainty about the future value of asset prices. So as you can see from the graphs, a similar degree of certainty about the future was present in the mid-2000s. So you can see there just before that big spike up. So there was a high degree of confidence then that the Great Moderation, so-called, was going to deliver robust growth and low inflation for a number of years to come. And obviously, as you can see what happened in 07 and 08, we don't need that graph to tell you that that didn't quite turn out as expected. So monetary policy is also an important input into the pricing of financial markets, assets, obviously. So a reduction in the perceived uncertainty around central bank policy settings may also have contributed to low financial market volatility. Monetary policy settings have been relatively stable in recent years, and where central banks have adjusted interest rates or their purchases of assets, these changes have tended to be gradual and clearly signalled in advance. A number of central banks have also made greater use of forward guidance as a policy tool to attempt to provide more certainty about the path of monetary policy, future path of monetary policy. But while central banks may act gradually and provide this guidance, the market doesn't have to believe the guidance will actually come to pass. Just because we say something doesn't mean it's going to happen. There are any number of instances in the past where central bank forward guidance didn't come to pass. 2007 would be a good example of that. So in my view, it's much more important for the market to have a clear understanding about the central bank's reaction function. That is, how the central bank is likely to adjust the stance of policy as the macro conjuncture evolves. If that's sufficiently clear, then forward guidance doesn't obviously have any large additional benefit and actually runs the risk of just adding noise or sowing confusion. Hence, anyway, an explanation for the low volatility could be the assumption of a stable macro environment together with an understanding of the central bank reaction function rather than the effect of forward guidance per se. Another potential explanation for the low level of implied volatility could also reflect greater investor willingness to take on financial market risk. and that's consistent with measures that suggest demand for derivatives which protect against uncertainty has declined. It's also consistent with other indicators of increased investor appetite for financial risks, such as the narrowing of credit spreads. This increased risk appetite may in part reflect the low yield environment of recent years. Protection against uncertainty is not costless, and so detracts from already low returns. So the point being, if you've already got low returns, you don't necessarily, you might think twice about whether you're going to pay for the insurance against those low returns, because it's going to significantly reduce your nominal payout, at least in the short term. There's also been an increased interest in the selling of volatility-linked derivatives by investors to generate additional returns. So not only do I don't insure my portfolio against uncertainty, I actually start selling the insurance and try and amp up my returns that way. So effectively, some market participants have been selling insurance against volatility. They've earned the premium income from those buying the insurance, and so they you keep on getting those. It's an insurance product. You get the premium income while ever volatility remains lower than expected, but you have to pay out when volatility rises. So in recent years, if you think back to that graph I showed you of volatility, there was a steady stream of premium income to be had. But the payout, when it came, was large. And I'll come back to that when I talk about the episode we saw at the end of January, early Feb. So what we've got is reduced demand for volatility insurance and increased supply, and lo and behold, reduced demand, increased supply, price goes down. So the cost of volatility insurance goes down. Such an extended period of low volatility is not that we've seen over the second half of last year is not unprecedented, although the recent episode was the longest in several decades. So what we've done here is just look at periods of low US equity market volatility over the last few decades. And you can see here that the most recent episode, the one in red, was one of the longer-lived episodes. So if you think about some of those prolonged periods of low volatility have sometimes been followed by sudden increases in volatility, although generally not to especially high levels, and a repricing of financial assets. A rise in volatility could be associated with a reassessment of economic conditions and expected policy settings, in which case one might not expect that rise to last that long. So if you just have a level shift in your assessment of economic conditions and the expected policy response, you'll have a spike in volatility, but it won't necessarily persist. So it'll spike up and then go back down. In contrast, a structural shift higher in volatility requires an increase in uncertainty about future outcomes rather than just simply a reassessment of them. But just as I find it puzzling that term premia in fixed income markets have been so low for so long, I similarly find it puzzling that measures of volatility don't seem to embody much uncertainty either. So the recent spike in volatility in early February is interesting in terms of the market dynamics, coming as it did, as you can see here, after a prolonged period of low volatility. So let me just talk a bit more about that most recent episode, because I think it has some interesting, or may have some interesting insights as to how things might go in the future. From around September 2017, there had been a rise in bond yields, most notably in the US, as confidence about the outlook for the US and global economy continued to improve. This rise in yields accelerated in January of this year, again most notably in the US, in large part in response to the passage of the fiscal stimulus there. So let me just, as you can, so this is taking, this is a shorter run picture of the 10-year Treasury yield, broken down into its real and inflation compensation components. So as you can see here, the rise in Treasury yields in the first part of this year reflected both a rise in real yields and a rise in compensation for inflation. This reassessment of the macro outlook was also reflected in a reassessment, albeit relatively small, of the future path of monetary policy in the US. Now, we get the inflation compensation component from TIPS, so it's easy to break that out, but it's worth noting that the real yield can incorporate any risk premium on the underlying asset, so it doesn't necessarily solely reflect, the way this calculation is done at least, solely reflect that this must be an upgrade in the real outlook. So the recent rise that you can see there in the real component through the second part of last year may also be a result of a change in the assessment of investors about the riskiness of US Treasuries, as well as an upgrade in the outlook for the US. So in light of the reassessment of the macro environment, it was somewhat surprising that through the month of January, equity prices in the US rose as strongly as they did. So as I discussed at the outset of this speech, I would expect that a shift upwards in the structure of interest rates would result in the repricing of asset prices more generally. In January, we didn't have that. Well, most of January didn't have that, but in late January, that is indeed what happened. Equity prices declined again most sharply in the US. There was a sharp rise in volatility. If you think back to that graph I put up earlier in the speech, there was a big spike right at the end there, which is what happened in early February. But there's also interesting in looking at some of the market dynamics around that spike in volatility that we saw. So the initial rise in volatility was exacerbated by the unwinding of a number of products that allowed retail investors and others to sell volatility insurance. So it was a function of the unwinding of those products and the hedging by the institutions that had offered those products to their retail customers. Indeed, I said unwinding of those products, and winding is somewhat of a euphemism here, as in some cases the retail investors lost all of their capital investment. So it was very much a full unwind. And so I've run this line before, and I saw Ed Cooper and the Aints at the, not Macquarie University Bar, but the Sydney Uni Bar on last Friday night. Drawing on the Saints history, what happened in February was that we shifted from something where the investors should know your product, K-N-O-W, otherwise it very quickly becomes know your product, which is very much the attitude they got from some of the people who sold them those products. So what is particularly noteworthy about this episode is how much the rise in volatility and the large movements in prices was confined to equity markets. So while volatility rose in other asset classes, it didn't actually increase to particularly noteworthy levels. So let me just flick back here. So you can see in the top left-hand corner a pretty decent spike. So if intraday the VIX got up to 50, which is what the top left panel is, which is a decently high level in anyone's book. But if you look at the rise in volatility in other asset classes, you've got Australian equities, treasuries, or FX. Yeah, volatility went up, but if that was all you could see, you wouldn't actually think it was particularly noteworthy. So the spike was very much confined to US equities. There was also, particularly in episodes where there's a spike in volatility, there was unusually relatively little spillover to emerging markets. Normally when we see things like that, particularly in the US equity market, you see quite significant spillovers to emerging markets. And it seems to be that the fact that these products that were insuring against volatility were particularly associated with volatility in US equity prices, that appears to have contributed to the limited contagion. Also noteworthy, and you can't quite see it on this graph, is how short-lived the rise in volatility has been as of today. So we had that big spike up for 1 or 2 days, and then it's gone back down, not quite got back down to where it was in the second half of last year, but it's gone down to decently low levels. So in some of my discussions with market participants, one possible cause of this is that the unwinding of the volatility positions to date has largely been confined to retail investors. There are those reasonably high-profile products that retail investors bought. They got wiped out. Once they've got wiped out, those products have gone away. But they're actually relatively small in size. As best as I can tell, there doesn't actually seem to have been much adjustment in the volatility exposures of the large institutional market participants thus far. They're still out there. So that said, I think it's quite conceivable that what we saw in early February gives a foretaste of the sort of market dynamics that might occur if there were to be a future rise in yields as the market reassesses the outlook for output and particularly inflation. So we've seen this spike is actually to date being fairly short-lived. I think part of the reason why it was short-lived, it was confined to retail. Big institutional positions in volatility are still very much out there and basically haven't adjusted at all. So let me switch gears a bit and talk a bit about another consideration in thinking about the future developments in the yield structure, and that's the balance of demand and supply in the sovereign debt market. Now, it's often difficult to assess the degree of influence that demand and supply dynamics have on that market because there are some obvious parts in terms of the changing supply and dynamics, and then there's some less obvious parts. So sometimes supply and the obvious parts seem to matter, and sometimes they don't. But nevertheless, there are some noteworthy developments occurring at the moment that are worth highlighting. So let me just flick through to that. So what I've got here is, this is for the G3, so US, Euro area and Japan. So the grey bars on the top are the net new supply, so net issuance to the market each calendar year. And on the yellow bars on the bottom are asset purchases or purchases of these sovereign bonds by the three central banks. So we've got 2017. 2018 for this year incorporates the issuance of the US that the US Treasury has said they're going to do to fund the fiscal position this year. So it shows that the peak net purchases by the official sector occurred in 2016. This happened to coincide with the low point in sovereign bond yields. And you might say, well, that was the reason why sovereign bond yields were so low, but you've got to remember that the sovereign purchases are a reaction. You know, there is a reaction function going on here. They're reacting to the macro conjuncture at the time, which itself has a direct influence on the yield structure. That said, one of the main aims of the central bank purchases was to reduce the term premium, and it does seem to have had some success. So that, 2016, we had a decent amount of, net, the central bank purchases were larger than the issuance by the debt agencies. But in 2018, we're swinging back to what is the normal state of affairs, that there's going to be a net supply of sovereign debt to the market for the G3 economies, but that's going to be for the first time since 2014. And that reflects a few different developments. First of all, the Fed has started the process of reducing the size of its balance sheet last year by not fully replacing maturing securities with new purchases. Now, that's a very gradual process, but it's a different dynamic from the previous 8 years. At the same time, the US Treasury will issue considerably more debt than in recent years to finance the US budget deficit, which has grown from 2% of GDP in 2015 and will be over 5% of GDP in 2019 as the Trump administration implements its sizable fiscal stimulus. In Europe, the fiscal position is gradually improving, but the ECB has started the process of scaling back its purchases of sovereign debt, and there's some expectation they might cease entirely at the end of this calendar year. In Japan, though, the Bank of Japan is still undertaking very large purchases of JGBs, which are larger even than the sizable net issuance to fund Japan's fiscal position. Meanwhile, there's no expectation of significant reserve accumulation by central bank or sovereign asset managers, which can often take the form of sovereign debt purchases. So when they buy their reserves, it's often in the form of particularly treasuries. And financial institutions, which have been significant accumulators of sovereign bonds in recent years as they sought to build their liquidity buffers, are not expected to accrue liquid assets to the same extent again in the foreseeable future. So the net of all of this, at least in terms of identifiable demand-supply dynamics, is that we're going to get a fit in this year and certainly next year, there's going to be a different dynamic out there in sovereign bond markets than there has been for a number of years. So for a number of years, central banks have purchased duration from the market, but that is in the process of reversing. And one thing which is worth thinking about in terms of that is that most central banks don't manage their duration risk in their bond holdings at all. So in their asset purchase programs, they go out and purchase them. If the price changes, they don't adjust their portfolio to hit any particular duration benchmark. So they don't rebalance their portfolio in response to price changes, unlike most other investors, including ourselves actually, at the Reserve Bank, whose actions to rebalance their portfolios back to their benchmarks act as a stabilising influence. So if there's a rise in Treasury yields, then if I'm managing my portfolio to a benchmark, I am going to provide some stabilising influence against that rise in yields. An additional issue we're thinking about, particularly in the US, is that through its purchases of mortgage-backed securities, the Fed removed much of the uncertainty associated with the early repayment, a prepayment of mortgages by homeowners by absorbing the impact of prepayments on the maturity profile of its bond portfolio. Private investors, when they're holding those mortgage-backed securities, typically hedge this risk, and generally with treasuries, and their hedging activity contributes to volatility in rates. The Fed's been holding a lot of these mortgage-backed securities for a number of years. They don't hedge the risk, the interest rate or prepayment risk on that portfolio. And so that's removed some volatility from the market that would otherwise be there if those holdings were in private hands. So as the Fed winds down its balance sheet, it is putting this negative convexity risk back in the hands of private investors, and the associated interest rate volatility will return to the market. So to date, I've been discussing developments in the rate structure from the perspective of the investor. It's also, I'm just going to quickly look at how issuers have responded to the historically low rate structure. So what this shows you is turn to maturity in various bond markets around the world, both sovereigns and also corporates. and shows that many issuers have responded to the low rate structure and particularly the absence of any material term premium by lengthening the maturity of their debt, so terming out their issuance. Moreover, lower interest rates on their new issuance have resulted in the average duration of their debt rising by even more. So the first two panels show that it is true of most sovereigns. The Australian governments, the Commonwealth and state have proceeded along this path. The AOFM has significantly extended the curve in Australia by issuing out to a 30-year bond, and a number of bonds have been issued well beyond the 10-year maturity, which up until 2007 was the standard end of the yield curve in this country. That's also helped the state governments increase the maturity of their issuance. Now, one interesting exception to the general tendency to term out their debt is the US Treasury, which is undertaking a sizable amount of issuance, including right at the moment at the short end of the curve. So most people have responded to the low rates by terming out. The Treasury this year is funding a lot of the increased issuance in the T-bill market, so right at the front end of the curve. Corporates have also termed out their debt, and some corporates have issued debt with maturities as long as 50 years, which I think is interesting for at least two reasons. Firstly, most corporates don't last 50 years. It's an interesting concept that you're buying a bond on that. So it starts to look a bit more like equity when you're buying a 50-year corporate bond, I think. The Australian banks have also availed themselves of the opportunity to term out their funding for relatively little cost, and the recently implemented net stable funding ratio further incentivises them to do this, and my colleague Chris Kent talked about this a couple of days ago. So this is what, for the Australian banks, you can see here that their average term of their new issuance is pushed above 6 years, and it takes a bit longer to flow through to the stock, but the average maturity of their stock outstanding is now up to 4 years, having gone down as low as 3 years post-crisis. The banks have been able to issue in size at tenors such as 7 or 10 years. So it used to be the case if you talked to a bank treasurer, there's no way you could issue a bond longer than 5 years because there was no market for it. Turns out there is, at the moment at least, and it's actually quite cheap. So what that does do, though, obviously, is materially reduce rollover risk. So while the low rate structure has often been thought of as a challenge from the investor point of view, it has been seen as an opportunity for issuers to reduce their rollover risk by extending debt maturities, and most issuers have taken advantage of that. So let me finish up by summarising the main issues or questions I've highlighted here today. So the structure of interest rates globally has been at an historically low level for a number of years, it goes without saying. This has reflected the aftermath of the financial crisis and the associated monetary policy response. If the global recovery continues to play out as currently anticipated, one would expect that the monetary stimulus will unwind, which would see at least the short end of the yield curve rise. But at the same time, there have been factors behind the low structure of interest rates which are difficult to understand completely and raise questions about its durability. And I've discussed some of them here today. But regardless about what you think about whether or not the rate structure is going to remain where it is today or not, I think it's puzzling that there is little compensation for duration in the term structure. There's little compensation for the uncertainty about whether or not things are going to remain the same or whether or not that low rate structure is going to persist. At the same time, equity prices and other asset prices embody a view of the future that robust growth can continue without generating a material increase in inflation. Again, there is little priced in for the risk that this might actually not turn out to be true. The ongoing improvement in the global economy, together with the large fiscal stimulus in the US, has caused some investors to question these views. If interest rates continue to rise without a similar rise in expectations about future earnings growth, one would expect to see a repricing of other assets, particularly equity markets. Such a repricing does not necessarily mean a derailing of the recovery. Indeed, it's very much a consequence of the global recovery, but it may have a bit of a dampening effect. At the same time, we need to be alert for the effect that the rise in interest rate structure has on financial market functioning. And the recent spike in volatility that we saw in early February is one example of this. In my view, that was a small example of what could happen following a larger and more sustained shift upwards in the rate structure. As I said, the recent episode was very much confined to the retail market. The large institutional positions that are predicated on a continuation of the low volatility regime, they remain in place. That said, I've said at conferences like this before, a few years ago even, that I thought volatility would definitely be higher next year than it was this year, and that turned out to be wrong. I think I said at the beginning of 2016, which was the beginning of 18 months of particularly low volatility. However, this time around, I'm willing to say it again because I think there's a higher probability of being proven correct this time around. So let me finish there. And, sorry. What I was going to say is I'm happy to take any questions.
Yeah.
Or you were going to say that.
I expect many people will want to ask questions. Shall we start down here? Have we got a roving mic? Thank you very much. Can I ask everyone, when you ask a question, please state your name and the organisation that you represent.
Hello, my name is Herbert Chen. I'm an actuary and an accountant. I come from an actuary background, and my company is Herbert Chen Associate Proprietary Limited.
Thanks.
And I'm a Macquarie University alumni.
Oh, very good.
And my question, I got two questions. One that you're talking about supply and demand of money, and there's a major player, which is China, and you didn't mention too much about it. No, could you mention a little bit about China?
Sure.
And the other question I have is that if North Korea pressed the small button and Donald Trump pressed the big button, what happened next?
Wow.
So, as much as I'm a US politics, one of my pet topics, I'm not going to talk about that one. On China, I mentioned it's actually partly referring to it on the way through. So one other dynamic which I didn't talk about, I mentioned in terms of foreign reserve accumulation, at least in terms of China's influence on the rest of the world. China obviously has a very large reserves portfolio. It's around about three. It is very much not around about. It is almost exactly $3 trillion US dollars. Been around that level now for the past 12 months or so, probably getting 18 months or so now. But prior to that, it used to be a bit higher. It used to be over $4 trillion, and there was actually a decline in China's reserves holdings, which was fairly material. If you think about a portfolio rebalance or portfolio flow where someone... it's a portfolio rebalancing where a large player reduces the size of its portfolio by $1.5 trillion. It's a decently large number. Now, obviously, someone else bought the assets that they sold on the way through, and that's why I mean that often people focus on one part of the demand and supply dynamics without thinking about the other part. So China, from memory, 2015 and 2016, reduced the size of its portfolio by $1.5 trillion, including in some sovereign assets. But someone else was absorbing those flows on the other side, and their interventions in the FX market were in part response to capital outflows, obviously, by Chinese citizens and Chinese institutions. So they were buying foreign assets at the same time as SAFE was selling them. So I said it's important to think about both sides of the trade in that. But the other interesting thing about China, though, in terms of the numbers I was showing earlier, the Chinese financial system is a reasonably closed financial system to the outside world. The main interface is actually through SAFE's holding of FX reserves. So in terms of net supply and demand, in terms of global bond portfolios, they're a big player on the demand side, but not such a big story on the supply side.
Who else would like to ask a question? We'll take one here while the mic's close.
Thanks very much, Guy. My name's Yolene. I'm from the AOFM. So good to see you summarising our issuance there. I, too, have been a little bit puzzled as to why the US is shortening up their issuance, given, increased deficits on the horizon and everything else. I'd be interested to hear any thoughts you might have on the potential consequences of that.
Sure.
And I also was sort of left hanging after your statement about a lot of the volatility being caused by retail investors, but there's a lot of large institutional positions still out there. What you expect to happen? I guess they've sort of taken a bit of a hit recently, but have been able to sort of maintain those positions. But what happens if there is that ultimate repricing?
Yeah.
Does the contagion occur then?
Yeah, I just think as a point there, I'm not 100% sure, well, not even close to 100% sure how that will actually go, but I'd expect there'd be a bit of indigestion, to put it mildly, around that. My point being, though, and partly it affects, and it's something I said in the middle of my speech, if it's a spike in volatility which sharply retraces, then I don't have to adjust my... If I'm basing my portfolio construction on relative volatility, and that spike in volatility is temporary, then I don't have to readjust my portfolio. And so those large institutional positions which are based on relative volatilities haven't, you know, as of today, volatility is pretty much back to where it was at the beginning of the year. So the fact that they didn't adjust is fine. They don't have to adjust. It's more an issue if that volatility moves structurally higher because of structurally higher uncertainty. That's when the portfolio from the institutional side has to adjust. The retail didn't have any choice. The way those products were designed, as you had to pay out as soon as the VIX, in particular, because they were basically they were based on the VIX. As soon as the VIX spiked to a particular level, you had to pay out. In fact, this is one of the cases where it's interesting in terms of product disclosure. I think Elizabeth will like this one. So this wasn't one where the features of the product were buried on page 80 of the prospectus. This was actually in bold print on page 1 that if the that once the VIX spike, effectively once the VIX spikes to a particular level, we will wipe out all your capital. It said that in bold print on page 1. So there was no, there wasn't really any doubt about this. You know, there's actually, someone's filed a court case against one of the providers of those products today. Without prejudging the outcome of court cases, I think it would be hard to argue there wasn't adequate disclosure in this instance because it's there on page 1 in bold print and wasn't on, on the back. Mm. In terms of, sorry, I had a question about... we are seeing some... On the Treasury issuance, we are actually seeing some indigestion from that right at the moment. So starting in around about mid-February and going through until the end of the month, there's a very large volume of T-bill issuance hitting the market. We're about halfway through that. And you've seen a decent amount of repricing of money markets, both in the US and around the world. You've seen... LIBOR OIS widen to one of its widest levels in a while. That the Treasury issuance is part of the dynamic affecting that. There's a couple of other things going on in terms of around where some large US corporates are managing their cash holdings. But you're actually seeing that translate back into the local market. So as it's become more expensive for particularly financials to issue into the US money market, you've seen, as I said, LIBOR OIS has widened, and you've seen that translate back here into a widening in BBSW as well. And it's very much because as our banks have shifted back to issuing in this market because it's been more expensive to issue in the US, which is itself mostly a direct consequence of the US Treasury issuance. One thing which is interesting to think about, though, is that the Treasury's front-loaded its bill issuance into February and March, and after that it's actually doing a decently large chunk of its... financing for the whole year in 6 weeks, and then after that it actually drops back down. So it'll be interesting to see whether that's repricing again is temporary rather than permanent.
Someone else? Yes, down the front, please.
Hi, my name's Steve McKenna from T Corp. I'm on the investment management arm of T Corp. The entire Australian yield curve is now sitting below the US yield curve, I think, as we speak. What impact do you think that'll have for demand on Australian assets and the hedging activities, FX hedging activities of Australian investors? Because we used to get paid forward points and now we're going to be paying away forward points.
Yeah, it's interesting on the other side, though so that's true for you. It's the opposite for people coming the other way. So they actually, you know, if you're getting paid to hedge if you're coming the other way, which is somewhat attractive. I'm personally not that worried about the fact that where yield curves sit relative to each other. It's not obvious to me there's a dynamic, you know, amongst other things. So most other advanced economies have yield curves which sit below the US yield curve at the moment. We were one of the few exceptions. So it's not obvious to me that there's a trigger which gets flipped as soon as the spread, which had been sitting in low single digits, suddenly shifts, you know. It's not obvious there's a non-linearity at zero, let me put it that way, in terms of spreads between assets. It doesn't happen in most other assets. It's not obvious that sovereign fixed income is unique and stands out from those other assets. So, there's a shift in relative expected rates of return, and you'd expect some... the other thing I suppose worth pointing out is, so the fact, one reason why our yields are lower than those, you know, when... It's always important to remember about fixed income, when yields are going down, it's because the price is going up. So people have been buying their issuance. And that's one of the reasons why the price has gone up and the yields come down. So I always find it interesting to say, well, there's going to be a sudden lack of demand. It's like, well, no, hang on a sec. It's actually the demand which has actually pushed the price up and the yield below that in the US. So not obvious to me that there's anything particular about what happened. You know, there's a non-linearity at zero in terms of the spread between our 10-year yield and the US 10-year yield. Doesn't mean that some investors will react to that, but also at the same time, it's fairly clear that some other investors are reacting in the opposite direction to that.
Guy, can I just push you a little bit on that point? So, you know, thinking about the consequences of that flip in terms of the carry trade, I mean, for many, many years, the carry trade has been, you know, one of the most important stories to understand about the Australian dollar. And my personal view is that the carry trade kind of drove, because of that, the Australian dollar had this tendency, you know, up by the stairs, down by the elevator. What I've noticed is in the last couple of years, since that carry trade has kind of diminished and, well, now it's gone, that dynamic has changed. If you look at the distribution of the Aussie dollar, it's starting to look quite different. Is that something that the Reserve Bank cares about?
I mean, we do pay a bit of attention to the currency, but it comes to your question too. You also have to look at the hedged returns as well, and to whether or not those returns are hedged or otherwise. So the unhedged return is there's a negative differential now, but if you look at the hedging, if I'm a Japanese investor and I want to hedge that currency risk, then the basis is still, is working potentially in my favour. So, you know, you have to. So it's not just the unhedged rate of return that you look at. But then also, I mean, again, the point I was making earlier in response to the previous question, do interest differentials matter for the currency? Yeah, they almost certainly do, although it's difficult. It's always difficult to have them have a large, well, at least in our case, at least commodity prices seem to have the largest impact. But but as I said, there's any number of other currencies where the yield curves have sat below the US for a prolonged period of time, and their currency, you know, if I take Europe as a prime example, right, there's been a decently large appreciation of the euro against the US dollar over the last few years when the yield curve has been sitting happily well below that in the US. So I just don't see, you know, there's been a gradual process of convergence in yields over the last number of years. I just don't see that suddenly this flip is going to make any material difference. Best as I can tell, you probably know better, but the buying interest out of Japan hasn't materially changed over the last while. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I just don't see that there's much of a non-linearity right at zero. But the other thing you have to look at is the hedged differential as well as the unhedged one.
Okay. Can I also ask you about, you know, you've been talking about this trend of, you know, there's a massive amount of money sort of in this trade of selling volatility, which is, you know, selling options, which is, I guess, is another variant on the carry trade. So your point was retail investors have been blown out of the water. Institutional money is still heavily into that trade. When you say institutional money, are you talking, is it like, are you seeing a lot of players there that are regulated banks, or is it more unregulated, like pension funds?
No, I'm talking about very much about the asset management side, not about the bank side. But I'm not necessarily talking about it. There's a difference between strategies which are based on selling volatility insurance and strategies which are volatility based. That's quite a fundamental distinction. Yeah. So my strategy is on is on using leverage to ensure equal volatility in my fixed income and my equity portfolio. That's not that adjusts as the relative volatility of those two asset prices adjust, but I wouldn't describe it as selling volatility insurance. It's a volatility dependent strategy, but it's not a volatility insurance strategy. It's a volatility equalization strategy. Mm. I am sure that some large risk parity manager is going to come and tell, I've just got describing this hopelessly wrong, but but basically I would regard it as effectively a volatility equalization strategy across the asset classes. I said that those are the positions I'm talking about. What I mean is if there's a structural shift in the relative volatility between equities and fixed income opposite to what we've seen over the last over the last few years, then you will have to. There will be a large position readjustment. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen any of that, and that really depends on how long-lasting and how significant the shift in those relative volatilities are. That's what I'm talking about. Not, you know, yes, there's still some positions out there based on selling volatility insurance which didn't get unwound. I think that's the second order effect rather than the adjustment of strategies, which are, as I said, more in the volatility equalisation space.
Okay. Yes. Anybody else? Yes. Oh, we do have a couple more. Thank you.
Hi, Guy. Thank you very much for your talk. Jeffrey Sheen from Macquarie University. Do you think that any of the secular factors that have led to the downward trend in global risk and return across all asset classes, do you think any of those key factors are changing direction now? Do you foresee anything happening to the risk return trends?
Sorry, I'll answer that question in 1 minute or less. Yeah, thanks, Jeff. It's a very good question. I mean, to some extent, that's the question I was asking and trying not to answer in my talk. But I think if you look at, if I answer the question through the prism of the neutral rate, just as a simple way of addressing that, then, you know, most estimates have it declining quite sharply in 2008, and I think the main, an obvious explanation for that is for a large increase in risk aversion. I think there are a number of signs out there at the moment that you're seeing that risk aversion decline. In the real economy, I mean, you're seeing that risk aversion decline. You're seeing investment picking up around the world, corporates more willing to deploy their balance sheets. That strikes me that the increase in risk aversion, particularly in the third and fourth quarter of 2008 in particular, was very sharp. I'd be surprised to see as sharp an unwinding in the other direction, but I think you'll see that one you could see that one gradually unwind, and to some extent that's very much the debate in the US at the moment. Are we seeing that? Are we starting to see the neutral rate gradually drift up? You know, this is the R star debate in the US. It went down a lot in 2008. The question is it actually starting to shift back up again as that degree of extreme risk aversion that we saw in 08 is starting to back off?
We've got a question right down here at the front.
Hi, Sophia Rodriguez from Market News. Interesting comments on central bank forward guidance. Do you think your current forward guidance could be adding noise or sowing confusion, given that there are many, for example, Westpac's Bill Evans, who thinks that the rate will remain on hold this year and the next? So to have a guidance that there is no strong case for interest rate adjustment now, but the next move will be up and rate is under review at future meetings, are you trying to give a signal that you could be hiking anytime soon?
I think Phil made that fairly clear, Sophia, any time recently, and he said what you just said, which I think is reasonably clear. But I think, as I said in my talk, the main thing I think is to understand the reaction function, because circumstances are going to change and you want to have some idea what the reaction function will be to those changing circumstances. That, I think, is what's the most important. So, you know, it's not that we have any particular insight into how the future might evolve, but as the future does evolve, it's useful to have some idea what the reaction to that might be. As I said during my talk, I think that's, to some extent, the most important thing.
We've probably got time just for one more, so we'll take it down here.
Hi, this is Swati from Reuters. I just go slightly off topic here, and there's been a lot of conversation around immigration and population growth around Australia, and I just wanted to get some view from you on whether the RBA's outlook for growth gets affected for Australia if there's a clampdown on immigration or population growth, and do you just look at GDP, or is it also, you know, the quality of life that, you know, Australians have, and high density living and other impact?
Study Australia well off by area of core competency here. We care about population growth matters in terms of has an impact on GDP among, you know, doesn't necessarily have an impact on, you know, it's something which, you know, growth in the, well, more particularly growth in the labour force actually matters for future evolution of the productive capacity of the economy. but we take whatever it is more likely to be, that's what we take it as it is. We don't have an opinion as to whether or not how that goes, but it's something we need to be aware of, sure. But we'll take whatever others provide us with that. It's not something we, as I said, very much outside our core competency.
Okay, well, look, that has been a very illuminating discussion. I'm sure you'd like to join me in thanking again Dr. Guy Debelle before we head out for morning tea. Thank you, Doug.